One of the godfathers of mid-century modern architecture was a man named Richard Neutra. Neutra was an Austrian-American architect who designed more than 300 homes in California and elsewhere between 1927 and 1969. His son, Raymond Neutra, has been instrumental in keeping his father's work alive and runs the Neutra Institute for Survival Through Design. I am so excited to have him on the show and to draw awareness to his efforts of preservation of this iconic architecture. Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I am absolutely honored to have Raymond Neutra on the show today. Thank you so much for being here, Ray.
Delighted to be here.
We were just talking about good design, and I would love your opinion on what good design is.
Good design, I think, is very much driven by the intention that is the design aimed at the well-being of the people who are in there? Is it paying attention to how they socialize, what they do? Is it paying attention to the landscape? Are we embracing the landscape we are given? Are we sitting in the landscape in a respectful way? And if we're doing new landscape, are we relating it to the constructed landscape? And this holds true for individual residences, apartments, schools, civic buildings. That there are many ways to skin a cat, but if you're not paying attention to those things, you don't have good design.
That's right. And I think the immediate feeling when you walk into a mid-century modern home and you experience this design is an immediate grounding. I always feel very calm, I'm awe-inspired, and I feel this immediate peace come over me when I see the floor-to-ceiling glass, the open floor plan. A lot of your father's works to me felt so bold and so strong and sturdy and peaceful. So I think that is something that I always experience people falling in love with these homes and wanting that experience. So your father's work is very well documented, and you have been documenting that so well and providing information to the public through your website, neutra.org. Do you think that his personality and his beliefs really shaped his work? And do you think that connected him with certain clientele?
You know, he was born in 1892, and so he grew up in a very different world. He grew up in an empire. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was a multi-ethnic empire. And at the time that he was growing up, there was a lot of thought about making it a more just and affordable kind of place. So he was very influenced by Otto Wagner and Adolf Loos, who were aiming toward a greater simplicity. But then he and Rudolf Schindler, along with Gropius and Mies and Le Corbusier, all discovered Frank Lloyd Wright's 1910 Wasmuth portfolio. And this really blew them out of the water. And so he wanted to get to the United States, but he was caught up in World War I as an Austrian officer, and he spent his time on a horse with an artillery piece going through the Balkans. So he had experienced all kinds of different ethnicities in that experience. And when he got back, he kept trying to get to the United States, and finally in 1923 he did, and he was able to meet Louis Sullivan, whose kindergarten chats he was trying to get published in Europe. And at Louis Sullivan's funeral, he met Frank Lloyd Wright, who he had been writing to. And he ended up working with Wright for half a year, and then it was clear there weren't going to be much more jobs with Wright, so he moved on to California and moved in with Rudolf Schindler. So his commitment was to the landscape, to the physiological well-being of people, because he had been reading the writings of Wilhelm Wundt, the great physiological psychologist, and also to new technology, to use it in a way that would make this kind of living affordable through prefabrication and things like that. So this was the focus, and in for the first decade or so, it was a lot of technological exploration. And then starting in the 40s, he is focusing back again on his physiological interests, and he started writing essays about that, which ultimately were published as Survival Through Design 14 years later in 1954. So you have that progression. And when he founded the Neutra Institute in 1962, I was a young medical student at McGill at that time and was communicating with him about it. He was trying to use the legacy and the fame that he had gotten to give a boost to people who were doing research and trying to learn more about what resulted in well-being. So when you and I have this feeling of calm and peacefulness when we come into the space like in your beautiful living room where we're sitting now, it's because my father and the people that were following him and Mr. Wright were kind of responding to something very deep, something that's hundreds of thousands of years old, with humans sitting with their back to a safe tree and looking out over the landscape for hyenas and game, right? There's something about this that is hitting something very deep and physiological. It's not a question of the latest fashion statement.
Right. When I met you about 9 years ago, we met with Leo Marmol and your brother, Dion, at the time. And we were at the Neutra House, and there was a lecture about this architecture. And the two things that I remember taking away from it was, one, just what you said, that we have a Homo sapien need to be in nature and to have homes that show us nature. And then two, which was very interesting to me, was that people at that time were receiving the homes so horribly. This new design was considered to be ridiculed, and these homes were considered to be vulgar. I don't know if you remember that part of the lecture, but we have this response to them that is so strong. How do you look at that as what people were calling the homes at that time, or labeling them?
Yeah, moon architecture. I think that part of the reason that it got fame in the arts world was that it was new. We, you know, modern painting, modern architecture. So it was a shocking departure. In Japan, it wouldn't have been such a shocking departure because that was part of their tradition. And even though it can get very cold in Japan, nonetheless, they wanted to be relating to nature. In the European tradition, it was to close oneself in from the cold. And so we also have conditioning of what we're used to, and it takes a while to see that you're really going back to something that is much older than castles and Hansel and Gretel houses. And yet the rich materiality of something like the lovely Hans and Gretel houses in Carmel, we were just walking around there, and it's a lot of fun to see them. So that the severity of trying to use technology to achieve this meant that you had lots of handicraft things that were too expensive. Green and Green is fine for the owners of the Gamble soap company, but it's not something so easy to have for every man or every woman. So I think that that was part of it. Now, at least there are some people who can look at this architecture and it isn't so shocking anymore. And there's the issue of preservation. What should our approach be to these buildings, which are now three generations old? The Neutra Institute was given three Neutra design buildings in the Silver Lake District by my late brother. And we are trying to pattern and model good behavior. We did historic structures reports. One of them actually donated by the students at USC who did it as a class exercise, the other one that we paid for. And then systematically we're going about doing a delayed maintenance. My brother, of course, had stewardship of these buildings and did not do anything violent to them, but there also is some, you know, delayed maintenance that we're doing. The other thing that we're doing is using these buildings for exercises of those who are training people who are preservationists. So those USC students did their project there. In our newsletter, which will be out in just a little bit, we describe a class that was held there describing how to do historic photography and into doing Matterport walkthroughs to document such buildings. And increasingly, we are doing webinars with people who have successfully rehabilitated some of these properties. For example, if you go to our resources section under webinars, you'll see a presentation by the head ranger at the Painted Desert Visitor Center and Community, where that has been named a National Historic Monument, and it's he describes what they're doing to repair it. And we'll be doing other ones with residential and with multi-household structures and schools and so forth that show what good behavior is. And then when we can, we try to oppose bad behavior. I'll be testifying before the Board of Supervisors in Monterey in a week about a very sad episode where a Silicon Valley millionaire, Massey Medipour, bought a 1958 Neutra house, and she claimed she didn't know it was a Neutra house at first, but she wanted to buy the property to tear it down and have a Ricardo Ligoretta build a house for her there, and she has a Frank Gehry house in Tahoe. And so this was quite a big project, and neighbors opposed it, and then preservationists realized what was going on, the Association of Monterey Area Preservationists, of which I'm now a member. And so they hired Barbara Lamprecht and Anthony Kirk to make an appeal to the State Office of Historic Preservation. And there was a meeting in 2014 where the panel looked at the thing and said, yes, this is historic, put it on the state list, and it is eligible for the national list. So the house which we bought, which was inhabited, is now uninhabitable. It's been left over. Vandals have come through, and then a year after it was declared formally historic, a mysterious event happened. Somebody came into the house with a chainsaw and spent many hours cutting through all the supports. We don't know whether this was a new kind of vandal, which was a threat to everybody in the community, or some other explanation, but she was required to shore up the building, but that was 2014, and the house has continued to go downhill. So my testimony is that this is to allow this house now to be torn down on the grounds that it has deteriorated reminds me a little bit about the joke of the man who killed his mother and father and fell on the mercy of the court because he was an orphan.
Oh my gosh.
So
it's just horrible.
So we try to resist things that have gone south, but I think it's more important to try to model and promote good behavior with regard to these historic structures.
Absolutely. I'm always telling people that, you know, if they do want their home preserved, if they want people to respect it, they themselves have to take care of it. And we have so many great resources. Someone like Leo Marmel, who has restored and maintained these homes, you know, we urge homeowners who are listening to really seek out these specialists and to take care of the architecture, to preserve it, to keep it as it is. And the more you do that, the more people will respect it. Can people donate on your website, or how would you recommend they do that?
Right now, we're not looking for donations, but we are looking for partners that people have stepped forward in the most inspiring way. There is a group of Neutra owners who are forming a Neutra owners network to share contractors, tips, sources of materials. And they've actually raised the money to have a beautiful page on our website. People have volunteered in many interesting ways. So we urge you to reach out. There's ways that you can contact us. And I encourage you to look at the website. We try to preserve not only objects, but also archives and ideas. And you'll find on the website a really interesting documentary that was done in 1968 in Germany. And one volunteer has translated into English, so we have English subtitles. And as we speak, there's a professor in China who's making Chinese subtitles. So the ideas are there. And then my mother was my father's executive assistant and played the similar kind of role that Aline, Eero Saarinen's wife, played a big role. But she was also a musician. And my son found that a record that she had made in the late 50s was available on eBay, exactly pristine. And another owner, Will Thomas, who's a music producer, has digitized that record. So if you go onto the website, you can see both of those things.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Raymond, and thank you for your work in preservation. It's really wonderful to see.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.